Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along, folks. David Dave makes a welcome, another welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been here on, three or four occasions.
Four, for
his number of books. He's a highly prolific historian. So I will introduce him briefly. He's known to many of you. He's a graduate of Melbourne and Cambridge Universities. He was a research fellow at the Clare College in Cambridge and professor of Australian history at University College in Dublin before taking up a senior research fellowship at La Trobe University in Melbourne. And he's twice served as Professor of Australian Studies at the University of Tokyo, and been an Archives Bifellow at Churchill College, Cambridge, and a visiting professor at the University of Aberdeen. He's written many books, including Studies of Winston Churchill. He spoke here for his book on Fisher, the former Australian Prime Minister. And David's most recent book is Claiming a Continent. The most recent book is Conquest, How Societies Overwhelm Others. But tonight he's here on the occasion of the launch of Antarctica, a biography, which has recently come out, and we're going to have David talk to us tonight on the colonisation of Antarctica. David Day, you're very welcome. Thanks.
Thank you, Jared, for that, once again, another kind introduction. It seems a bit weird talking about the colonisation of Antarctica. I mean, how can you colonise this ice-covered continent? But in fact, that was the title of a memo that the American government had in 1939. What I want to do, first of all, is talk something about the backstory. How did America get to the stage where President Roosevelt instructed that Antarctica be colonised by the United States? Well, it started, to some extent, it's got an Australian dimension because Douglas Mawson, Australia's Antarctic explorer in 1911, went south to Antarctica with the express purpose of claiming it on behalf of the British Empire, the first explorer to have it as his primary purpose, going to Antarctica with the idea of claiming territory. And when he came back, he didn't have authority to do it, but he went and raised the British flag down there, and I think also the new Australian flag, and claimed willy-nilly wherever he went. But he had no authority from the British government to do so. But nevertheless, when he got back, he pressed the British government and the Australian government to try and claim particularly what he called the Australian Quadrant, which is the quarter of Antarctica below Australia. In fact, it spreads right across to below India. It could just as easily be called the Indian Quadrant as the Australian Quadrant. And so he wanted this to be claimed, and the British government in 1919, in the person of Leo Amery, decided that they would in fact claim not only the Australian Quadrant, but they would claim all of Antarctica. And they would surreptitiously, step by step, bring all of Antarctica within the British Empire. At the time, all they had was some sub-Antarctic islands plus the Antarctic Peninsula, that area just south of South America. But they decided they would do this step-by-step thing. So they started by taking the Ross Sea, that slice of the Ross Sea that extends all the way to the South Pole, and claimed that, which they did in 1923, gave it to New Zealand and put it under New Zealand administration but under British ownership. And the next stage then was to do the Australian Quadrant. The only problem was that the French had this nice little slice, not quite in the middle of it, but to the eastern side of it. And they hadn't been there for 100 years, or nearly 100 years, but they had claimed it in 1840. And they reminded Britain that, in fact, this was French. And, you know, I guess they were willing to spill some French blood to defend this territory. So by then, when they started discussing with France whether they would really stand by this claim, or wouldn't they rather have, you know, exchange some islands for it and let Britain have it, the French made clear that, in fact, they wanted that slice and they wouldn't give it up. So Britain then had to concede that it wouldn't have all of the Antarctic. At the same time, Norway, which had become very important in terms of whaling in Antarctica, sort of let Britain know that, in fact, well, you know, Amundsen had got to the South Pole first. He had raised the Norwegian flag at the South Pole, named it King Haakon Plateau, and it was really part of Norway. Moreover, you know, our whalers had explored much more than Britain had in recent times. So they also had aspirations in the Antarctic. So Britain was now confronted by these two claimants, rival claimants, who weren't going to let go. Meanwhile, you know, Argentina and Chile were also saying, well, you know, that Antarctic peninsula that you think is yours is actually ours. It's actually part of Argentina or part of Chile, depending on who was speaking. So then, you know, the 1930s, things opened up again with increase in whaling, the arrival of the Germans and the Japanese, who wanted to be independent in terms of animal fats. So they went into whaling in a big way. They wanted the whale oil, not only as a foodstuff, but also as an explosive. It was a vital element in the creation of nitroglycerine. And of course, they both had war in mind. So they started, the whaling fleets from Germany and Japan started increasing down in Antarctica. By the late 1930s, of course, private American expeditions had been down to Antarctica and had claimed on their behalf, but without the support of the American government. They'd claimed areas on behalf of the United States, unofficially, and named them, things like Mary Birdland, Richard Bird naming Mary Birdland, and Lincoln Ellsworth going down there and naming a large area after his father. So there were these American claims, unofficial American claims, but that were starting to capture the American imagination, because they were starting to take wireless down there. So Bird was starting to broadcast direct from Antarctica into the living rooms of ordinary Americans. And he very smartly as well, when he set up his temporary base down on the Ross Sea, called it Little America. So there was Little America 1, 2 and 3, because he set it up on the ice shelf, and of course 1 floated out to sea followed by 2 and 3. So they didn't last there, but instead it did, though, give a sense of American ownership of this place. And there were increasing calls on the United States government to actually do something about it, to actually back up these private claims with an official one. Things heated up in 1938 when the Germans followed up their whaling fleets by actually sending an official expedition. And they sent it by way of a catapult ship, a ship that was able to catapult aircraft into the air. They were going to show the rest of the world that they were technologically superior to them and that their claims were therefore superior to those of other countries. They weren't going down there with dogs and sledges. They were going down there with aircraft. And they weren't going to, you know, the Americans and the British had been down there with aircraft and they dropped flags onto the ice. The flags had just sort of dropped flat onto the ice. The Germans were going to go one better. They developed a javelin with swastikas on the flights. This about 6 foot high, rather heavy, and it was designed to be dropped from an aircraft and stick into the ice, so that the swastika would actually be raised on Antarctica. It wouldn't fall flat onto the ice. So symbolically, this was seen as superior. So this catapult aircraft, which would allow many more flights because it could be dispatched despite the weather, you know, even if the seas were too rough to let off, to allow an aircraft to take off, it would still be able to be catapulted off and then be able to land in the lee of the ship on its return. And all the areas that at the time people were flying across Antarctica and claiming all the areas they could see to 150 miles on each side of the plane and 150 miles further than the furthest extent of the plane. So huge areas were now being claimed because of aircraft. So this, when the news of this expedition reached Washington, this caused Roosevelt and the State Department, which had been moving towards the idea of making a claim, to go one step further and to send an official expedition to Antarctica. At the time, Byrd had been planning to send another private expedition down there, and he'd sort of half organised it. And he immediately offered his resources, the ships that he'd got ready, to give over to the American government and for him to lead it. And he was an old moose hunting partner of Roosevelt. They were great friends. Byrd's brother was a senior and powerful Democratic senator. So Roosevelt very readily agreed to give Byrd the leadership of this expedition. So in 1939 then, the Americans decided that they would establish three bases around the coastline of Antarctica. Another base they also planned on Heard Island, which, as you may know, is Australian, or we thought it was. But the Americans, because their whalers had been down there in the 19th century, regarded it as their own. And they wanted Heard Island, which is to the southwest of Western Australia, as a possible landing place for an air route that would go from North America down through South America, Antarctica, Heard Island, Australia, and the Philippines. So it'd connect up with the American Philippine colony in case the air route across the Central Pacific was cut by hostile Japanese action, because this was all about preparing for a possible war in the Pacific. Well, they found out that, of course, Heard Island was unsuitable, it was rocky, it was mountainous, and moreover, they couldn't even use it for seaplanes. There were no sheltered bays or sheltered lagoons, so Heard Island got dropped off. But they added a new base. They developed what they called a snow cruiser. And the snow cruiser was the size of a railway carriage. It was actually built in the Pullman Railway Works at Chicago. So it was this huge lumbering beast with tyres that were bigger than had ever been built before. They were literally 10 feet high, built especially for this snow cruiser. So it had four tyres, it had a massive big engine. Plus, it also had four other engines that operated the wheels separately, so that if one wheel fell down a crevasse, it could be lifted up and the snow cruiser could keep going. The snow cruiser was meant to be, well, it was meant to be able to rescue anyone who got stuck out there in the Antarctic, as Byrd did on one of his previous expeditions, but it was also meant to show the superiority of American technology. They would go one better than the Germans. And this thing was so superior that it was meant to be able to house and sustain four men for a year and act as a laboratory. So, and the piece de resistance of it was that it had a plane on its roof. So this huge monster of a thing also had a plane on its roof with a sloping back to it so that the plane could simply be taken off. You know, they'd build a ramp of snow up to the back and then just slide the plane off. And the plane could then fly off and do all that climbing. And it was believed that the snow cruiser and the plane combined, with the snow cruiser supposedly being able to go 30 miles an hour, would be able to crisscross all of Antarctica within a year and survey 5 million square miles. And then at the end of it, park itself at the South Pole with these four guys inside. and thereby Antarctica potentially would be American. Nobody would know Antarctica like the Americans. They would have flown over and photographed all of it, named all the major features on it, and have bases surrounding the continent plus this snow cruiser. Well, the best laid plans. To start with, because it was so hurried, one of the ships had to be left behind, so they only had two ships. Instead of taking 18 months to prepare an expedition, as Byrd usually did, he had to get this done and off in 6 months. So he only took two ships with him and could only establish two bases. One was at McMurdo on the Ross Sea, and the other was to the east, just at the bottom, as it were, of the Antarctic Peninsula, on an island off the Antarctic Peninsula. It was actually a base that the British had used and recently abandoned. And the Americans now arrived and called it. It was called by the British Barry Island. The Americans immediately renamed it as Stonington Island, in memory of the early sealers from the 1820s who came from the port of Stonington. And then they named all the geographical features around it after the crew members of those sealing fleets from the 1820s, because it was argued by the Americans at the time that they had in fact discovered Antarctica. So they had this claim based upon discovery. It was wrong. The Russians had actually discovered it sometime before the Americans. But they had a claim based upon discovery, and now they were going to reinforce it with a claim based on exploration and settlement. Because what they were going to do was colonise it. They were going to do what the British had said was impossible, that you couldn't have permanent settlements. But the Americans were going to establish permanent settlements, with the staff of the settlements being relieved each year. But they would be there year-round. As American settlements. Well, as I said, the best laid plans. The other problem was the snow cruiser. This marvellous technological invention with its smooth round tyres. The smooth round tyres have a bit of trouble getting purchase, particularly with a hugely heavy vehicle, getting purchase on the snow. They'd only had time to build it and test it on sand dunes. But the Antarctic is rather different from sand dunes. And when they got it with great difficulty from the ship onto the ice and almost lost it into the sea when the part of the ramp broke away, they found it wouldn't move forward. So they put two extra tyres. They had spare tyres in the back of this thing. They put two extra tyres on the back and tried driving it in reverse. And they managed with great difficulty driving it at extremely low speed in reverse, and managed to get several kilometres, and then gave up and made it a stationary laboratory next to their little America 4 on the Ross Sea. Well, Congress had also been very ambivalent about the whole idea. America was coming out of the Depression. They were very ambivalent about the idea of spending $350,000 just for the first year of sending these people down and establishing the base. By the time that they'd left in November 1939, other things were happening in the world. And there was even less reason to go. The Germans, of course, were no longer going to go back, as they'd announced they would, and establish a base down there. They had other things on their mind. So the Americans, once they went down there, did some surveying. They had no scientific program at all. They'd had a meeting before they left, but they had no written scientific program. So it was a great schmozzles in terms of science, and not terribly much was achieved in terms of surveying, charting and naming places with American names. At the end of the summer, once they'd got established, Byrd returned to the United States and with the war starting, recommended to Roosevelt that the expedition be wound up and that the men be returned to the United States. Roosevelt, though, was still keen on remaining there. He was keen on this idea of colonisation. The only problem was that Congress wouldn't give him the money, so they refused to give him any more funds other than for the emergency evacuation of the bases, and that is what happened. The bases were quickly evacuated at great speed. The one that was on the Antarctic Peninsula was done on a fly-in. It had to be done by aircraft. The ship couldn't get to the base, so an aircraft came in. All the men just left everything behind and tumbled into the aircraft, and which took them off to the ship. Well, of course, what the Americans had done by announcing their intention and the scale of their territorial ambition was to alarm the other territorial claimants, particularly Britain and Argentina. Because one of the justifications, particularly for Argentina, one of the justifications that the Americans used was that it was all being done under the Munro Doctrine. Well, according to the Argentinians, the Munro Doctrine didn't extend. You know, this was about South America, the Americas. It wasn't about Antarctica. The Munro Doctrine couldn't extend that far south. And they were very alarmed that the Americans were going to claim part of what they regarded as Argentine territory. So the Argentines reacted by setting up bases of their own once the Americans had withdrawn. And the British too, despite the war, sent Marines down there to establish bases, Marines with scientific background by and large, to establish bases with the ostensible reason that they were there for scientific purposes, but they were really there for claiming purposes, both to ward off the Argentinians, because they were competing with the Argentinians, but also to signal the United States that this part of British territory wasn't going to be claimed by the United States. So there was the Antarctica was therefore prepared at the end of the war for a new race to claim territory. The Americans returned in great numbers. They sent a huge fleet down there because now they were thinking of Antarctica not for its own sake, but for the possibility of it as a testing ground for a war against Russia, because they foresaw that there would be a war against Russia within several years and that war would be largely launched from the Arctic. The only problem was they couldn't practice for such a war in the Arctic, because Canada tended to get a bit upset about it, as did Greenland at the time. So they sent a fleet down there to practice setting up bases on the ice. So they sent down aircraft carriers and a submarine, plus other warships to back them up, with the idea of showing the practicability of setting up bases quickly on the ice. The submarine, of course, didn't fare too well and had to be towed away when it crashed into some ice. But the aircraft carrier took down 6 DC-3, these giant DC-3 aircraft, which could barely fit on the flight deck. It couldn't be lowered down, had to be transported on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier, and they were all launched into the air using jetpacks attached to the wings and then landed on the Antarctic ice and used to explore and survey and photograph as much of the Antarctic as they could. This included the Australian Antarctic Territory, which had been claimed back in 1935. And one of the most interesting things that I found in doing all the research for this book was opening a box in the American archives and unfolding this map that was drawn up by the State Department and the CIA in 1947-48, showing all the potential areas in Antarctica that could be claimed by the United States, because there was a big move on in those years, in the late 1940s, to actually lay claim to it. And this map was so so illuminating because there were pink splodges, pink not being the British Empire, but the American Empire, all over Antarctica, including huge splodges on the Australian Antarctic Territory because of that post-war fleet exercise, which had seen those DC-3s fly over much of Antarctica. In the event, of course, the Americans refrained from making a claim. It was simply too hard and too fraught with difficulties for them to do so. This was at a time, you know, the Berlin airlift was going on, the Cold War was starting to freeze over, the possibility of war was coming closer. Why would you make a claim in Antarctica and anger Britain, Norway, Australia, Argentina, Chile, and New Zealand? It would be madness. So that map was put away and stayed in the archives in Maryland, and the United States instead decided that it could do everything it wanted to do without actually making a claim, because it had always said that it didn't recognise anyone else's claim and would never make one of its own, or reserved its right to make one of its own, rather. It could continue doing this, set up bases wherever it wanted, without a by your leave with any of the claimant nations, and simply exercise the sort of freedom of movement and de facto sovereignty that it needed to do in Antarctica. This, of course, led to everybody else responding in kind. So as soon as the United States decided that it wanted once again to have permanent bases, of course, Australia, even New Zealand, Russia and the Antarctic then, over from the late 1950s onwards, came to be colonised by the world at large. And now, of course, there are many, many bases all around Antarctica, which all sprang from that original decision in 1939 by President Roosevelt, which is really the turning point. If you're looking at Antarctic history, it is really the big turning point in Antarctic history, which has led to the state of affairs that we have today. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Right on time. So Janet Grundy's got some copies of Antarctica, a biography, outside. So we'll come to questions and discussion. I mean, as you know, you've written about conquest and colonisation, and the normal idea of it is that you go into a country and you get something out of the country and you occupy the land, but has anyone got anything out of Antarctica? I mean, what at this stage, and what might they get out of Antarctica in the future? Because so far it just seems to be a place where people go and explore and get cold, but they don't come away with very much.
Well, originally, you know, Captain Cook went down there and said it'd never be worthwhile anybody going down there. But, you know, by the way, the offshore islands are actually full of seals, full of fur seals, which led immediately to what amounted to almost a gold rush as American and British, and even sealers from Australia rushed across the Pacific Ocean to lay waste to those sub-Antarctic islands. And within 2 years, all the fur seals from those islands were gone. Millions of them were gone. It wasn't until the 20th century that technology caught up in terms of whaling, and they were able to go whaling in the Antarctic with the explosive harpoons. It wasn't possible before, but now they could. So whaling was really important and very, very lucrative. Right up until the 1940s and 50s, before they'd almost killed most of the whales, and the returns declined. In more recent times, several countries have gone down exploring for oil, and they've found parts of the sea off Antarctica very likely to hold large reserves of oil, billions of gallons of oil. It only requires it to become economic, And of course now they're learning how to do it by doing it in the Arctic and by doing it in Alaska. And the only thing that is stopping them is a move that was made by Bob Hawke and the French president back in 1990 when he looked at this proposal and said, this is bullshit. There was a proposal to mine in Antarctica, and he said, we can't have this. And his cabinet, who was prepared to rubber stamp a proposal by Gareth Evans and Graham Richardson, I think it was, to set up a minerals regime, bowed to Hawke's will on this and brought in a moratorium. And because Australia and France wouldn't agree to it, the other treaty powers couldn't either. So instead of having a minerals regime, a moratorium was put in place. But once that moratorium finishes, there is great wealth to be found in Antarctica. And there's also, you know, the value strategically as the gateway between the Atlantic and the Pacific.
There's no time on the moratorium, is there?
Yeah, there's a 50-year moratorium.
It's a long time. So it's 2040 or something.
Yes, but there is no sovereignty in Antarctica. Nobody owns it. No sovereignty is recognised. So there's nothing to stop a rogue nation going down there and drilling for oil tomorrow.
Right down the back, yeah.
You started out by talking about...
Just speak up a bit, I want to pick it up on the pod here. Okay.
You started out by talking about private expeditions and exploration to Antarctica. We then moved into a state, into a period where it was the states that were represented doing that. Is there anything today in the way that Antarctica is administered and looked after that would prevent a return to private enterprise exploring, exploiting Antarctica?
Well, it does. You know, the tourist ships that go down there don't ask permission or don't have to ask permission. They can just go down there. There is a sort of voluntary regime in place by which, you know, they're limited to the sorts of ships that go down there. But at one stage, there were ships that were capable of carrying 2,000 passengers that were incredibly vulnerable to the ice that were planning to go down there. Well, that has now been stopped. So that it's only sort of proper strengthened ships with limited numbers of passengers that can go down to Antarctica. But at the same time, there is an airline. There is an Antarctic airline that was started by a Canadian entrepreneur allied with a British Antarctic scientist who set up an airline that takes adventurers, by and large, but also services some of the bases down there. And they use small twin otter aircraft and bigger DC-4 aircraft, fly down from Chile without a by your leave to anyone, and they've actually set up a base of their own down there. Greenpeace had a base in Antarctica for a year or two. So it's quite possible. And there was a plan by an Australian businessman to set up a floating hotel in McMurdo Sound that would service passengers brought to it by Qantas. Qantas would fly the passengers down and they would stay in this floating hotel. And there is nothing, it didn't go ahead, I think, for financial reasons, but there is nothing legally that could prevent such a thing from happening.
The base right at the South Pole, it's called Amundsen Base, is that a United States base or is it international?
Yes. No, that's very much a United States base.
Just repeat the name of the base is which?
The Scott Amundsen base. Yeah. So it sort of pays homage to Scott and Amundsen,
but it's
very much a United States base. And it was set up on the South Pole for a deliberate reason. I mean, there's a practical reason because, you know, it's better for these sort of observations they wanted to make. At the time, what they wanted to do was to actually calculate exactly the dimensions of the Earth, because it was all the better to send intercontinental ballistic missiles. You can't do it unless you know the exact dimensions of the Earth. And that was a good place to do it from. Now it's got a huge new telescope that's been set up there for looking into space. I mean, it also has peaceful purposes as well. But it was the symbolic purpose of having it at the South Pole that was seen as giving America greater priority in the Antarctic. The only problem, of course, is the polar plateau moves. The ice moves constantly at a slow rate, so that it's no longer at the South Pole. It's sort of moved off, and they have to keep moving that pole that signifies the position of the pole all the time to keep up with the ice. And I believe that the American base is now actually in the Australian territory. It's moved into Australian territory.
This question here, yes. Yep. Now you can stand up.
Yes,
there's no camera.
Okay. Yes. You talk about the treaty, I presume the Treaty of Antarctica. Does that mean that Australia has, being a participant of the treaty, I presume, has given up its sovereign right of its area? Or does it still have laws governing that particular area that Australia claims?
Yes. Yes, it still has laws. And it still maintains its claim to 42% of the Antarctic continent. But of course it's a claim that's not recognised by anyone else. What the treaty has done is supposedly frozen those claims. So in other words, supposedly you can't reinforce your claim during the operation of the treaty, and other people can't subvert your claim or challenge your claim during the operation of the treaty. But of course what happens is that the Australians are, of course, trying to reinforce their claim. They're maintaining new bases. They set up new bases after the treaty came in, and they engage in science and naming of features within the Australian Antarctic Territory. And you know, as I explained in the book, there was a real race between Australia and the Soviet Union, which established a base in the Australian Territory, and immediately it sort of, with greater resources, started flying over the Australian Territory, naming every mountain they saw, and Australia tried to race them to that so that they would have better maps, that they would know the Australian Territory better than any other nation, because they would do it not just from the air but also from the ground, so that they would have those essential ground control points that were necessary before satellites gave coverage of Antarctica, and therefore that they would have better maps. But in fact, you know, we claim sovereignty, but a sovereignty that's not recognised by anyone else except the few other claimant nations really isn't a sovereignty at all.
Just tell us before we go to the next question, what's the what happens at the other end? I mean, what's the score at the Arctic? What governs the Arctic?
Nothing much, really. It's not like the Antarctic Treaty. And there is real competition, as you'd know, you know, with the Soviet Union taking a submarine up there to put a Soviet flag on the seabed at the North Pole to show that this was Soviet. So there is a sort of a regime in place, but it's not as structured as the one in the Antarctic.
Stuart, and then
so, Janet. Yeah. So taking the point that you just said about the Soviet Union with the Arctic, were they in the Cold War interested in Antarctica like the United States was?
They tended to be more, I imagine they were interested in terms of determining the shape of the Earth for their own intercontinental ballistic missiles, but they, to the surprise of the Americans, the Russians actually seem to be interested in science. And instead of the intense rivalry and you know, lack of cooperation, there was an incredible amount of cooperation and great friendships built up, you know, with our own Philip Law and the leading Russian scientists. So they were talking on a sort of scientist-to-scientist level. The Americans were different because the Navy was running it, so it was very much a service, you know, an armed service organisation, whereas the Russians, it wasn't. It was an Antarctic organisation.
Scientific.
Yeah, so it was very much tended to be run by scientists. Mm.
Janet Grundy?
David, you've written a biography of a place. You usually write biographies of people.
I know.
So I'd very much like to know how you came to write this. And also, have you been there? Have you actually been down there?
Well, I'll answer the first question first. So, the other year I wrote the Seymour lecture on biography, and as part of the research for that, I looked up all the things about which a biography has been written, including London, a biography by Peter Ackroyd. The US dollar has its own biography. The humble cod has a biography. Although I initially was going to call this Antarctica a history, I was persuaded by my publisher to in fact call it a biography, and in many ways it is a sort of collective biography of all those strange and weird characters who had association with Antarctica, often for long periods. People like Burt, people like Lincoln Ellsworth, and Mawson, of course, who was associated with it for nearly 50 years. Now, as to the question, did I ever go down there? Have I ever been down? No.
Are you planning to?
Yes. No, I mean, I tried to go down there. I applied to the Australian Antarctic Division, and for reasons best known to themselves, they decided that they wouldn't give me space on their ship, and so I was going to try and get down there on a commercial tour vessel this summer, but my publisher said, David, you either produce the book or you're in big trouble. So, and the book was missing its deadline, and so I just didn't have the 6 weeks that it would have taken to go down. I think I also shrank a bit from the seasickness that I would inevitably endure on the trip.
But you haven't taken one of those flights?
No, I didn't think that would be as useful.
But did they start with the New Zealanders? Because, as you know, they had that tragic flight that was the accident, was 76. Were they one of the early planes to fly over?
Yes, and Qantas was doing it as well, and they both stopped for a time.
They both stopped around that time.
But as well, I mean, I had to toss up whether it was more important to go to the Whaling Museum in Norway or take time off and money. You know, this cost serious money, unless I got the Antarctic Division berth, to go to Antarctica, and, you know, Norway won. And as well, you know, going down and standing next to Mawson's hut would be illuminating up to a point, but it wouldn't really tell me what it was like for Mawson to be, you know, on his knees at the top of a 150 crevasse, shouting down to his mate 300 miles from his hut, knowing all his food or most of his food was at the bottom of the crevasse. His mate was dead, most of his dogs were down there dead, and he was likely going to be dead. I mean, I can imagine that just as well from Melbourne as from standing at Mawson's hut.
Question down there, yeah.
I'm just interested in talking about the characters. I've always been interested in Shackleton, and you haven't mentioned his name. Do you think he had any impact at the end of the day on what happened to the choice?
It's a question about Shackleton.
Yeah, I mean, he did, in the sense that you know, his expedition helped pioneer a new way to the South Pole, and then led to that race between Scott and Amundsen. But you know, he was, you know, one of these entrepreneurial types, a bit of a go-getter, a bit of a fortune seeker, a bit of a liar, a man, as the British would say, not of the top draw. So, you know, well, they say, you know, if you're in a tight spot, it was Shackleton that you'd want as your leader, and certainly, you know, he got them out of that tight spot when the ship sank from beneath them, and they had to go on that perilous voyage, and he got them all out. By contrast, of course, Mawson took three men off and came back by himself, lost two of them. And that really, really hasn't been explored very much. And he's been allowed, I think, to get away with too much. And
okay, so what's he been allowed to get away with?
Sorry?
What's he been allowed to get away with?
Well, I don't think people have examined sufficiently Mawson's, the preparations that Mawson did for that expedition, which was really badly prepared. the idea of putting all your food or two thirds or three quarters or whatever it is in one sledge and having it all go at once. The idea of turning around and seeing your colleague about to step onto a crevasse that you know is there, but you don't tell him to, in fact, hop onto his sledge so that his weight will be distributed more evenly. And it's probably the stepping onto the snow that caused Ninus to die. So that's for starters.
So you think he was irresponsible? You're not saying he was criminal. You're saying he's irresponsible.
Yeah, well, no, it's not criminal.
But it's reckless.
Yeah, reckless. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, I wonder, could I clarify a point? You were making the point that the South Pole is not where they think it is because the ice is shifting. Yeah. Is it the ice like a glacier or is it the continent itself that's shifting?
No, it's the ice is like a glacier. The ice is sitting on the continent and is moving inexorably towards the sea.
Yes.
So all the icebergs that come off are gradually coming off the continent. So the South Pole is still where it always is. The geographic South Pole doesn't move. The ice moves.
The continent itself might be moving away very slowly.
Well, if it is, it's infinitesimally slow compared with the ice, which I think is a yard or two a year.
Yes?
Yeah, just a guess. So what's your thoughts then for the future, say in 20, 30 years?
Yeah, well, there's an apparent stability to the regime as it exists at the moment, but it's sort of a false stability in my view, and it only requires somebody to call the bluff, as that Antarctic airline did, said, well, you know, we're going to start one up, we're not going to ask anyone, we're just going to do it. An oil company could conceivably go down to Antarctica, or somebody, a nation that's not an Antarctic treaty nation, could go down to Antarctica with an oil drilling ship and start drilling for oil. You know, Iran conceivably could do it. China could decide, well, you know, we really like the oil down there. You know, there's not enough in the South China Sea for us. We want the Antarctic oil as well. So what I think needs to be put in place is a more permanent regime, and a regime pretty much like, I think, I haven't read it in detail, but what the Liberal Party is pushing for at the moment, for Antarctica to be declared a World Heritage Area, and including the seas off Antarctica, because that's where the oil is, and that's where the interest will lie, and that's where the destabilising influence is. So that's got to be taken out of the equation, because that's the only way Antarctica will be protected. Because once oil is drilled for, of course, accidents are going to happen. There is absolutely nothing surer. And it would be an absolute disaster in the Antarctic.
Yes?
Do you mean Australia would have the largest say in that? Would they be the loudest voice in trying to do that?
I'm not sure what the Australian policy is. Australia still holds on to this fiction that it's got sovereignty over 42% of the continent. We've got to really let go of that, because we know we don't. We know we don't. If you look at the files in the External Affairs Department, they had legal advice, the New Zealanders had legal advice, the British had legal advice in the 1940s and 50s, that they simply hadn't done enough. They simply hadn't done enough to establish their sovereignty over those areas. And before the Australians got back there in 1954, you know, it took us 9 years after the war before Australia had a permanent base in Antarctica. Before that, of course, the Americans were there and had done a huge amount of surveying. And they had, as much or if not more claim to sovereignty. They just didn't actually implement that claim.
So tell us about the interest in the book. I mean, obviously it's not written not especially for an Australian market.
No.
So what's the interest in the Antarctic now in North America, Britain, other places? Or is the main interest in Australia and New Zealand and Latin America?
No. I mean, there is... In Argentina there is a lot more interest rather than in Chile. because Argentina is so passionate about the wrong that was done to them with the Falklands, and they regard, you know, the Antarctic Peninsula as part of that argument that they're having with Britain. Britain tried to defuse it by changing. Originally, the Antarctic Peninsula was called the Falkland Islands Dependencies, and then they cut that link and called it the British Antarctic Territory, and that was a way of stopping the world from seeing any connection between the Falklands and the Antarctic Peninsula, and would allow Britain perhaps to hand over the Antarctic Peninsula to Argentina without any implications regarding the Falklands. In other words, they could hold on to the Falklands but give away what they saw as being less valuable. So the interest then, you know, it's worldwide, you know, by people who are interested in the environment, by people who are interested in the history. The book will actually be published next year in January in the UK by Oxford University Press, and in May in the United States.
So we're getting towards the end. Have I missed anyone? So you've spoken here about the Weather Bureau, I think.
Yes.
And you've spoken here about Fisher.
Yes.
And you've spoken here now about Antarctica and something else, which I'm trying to remember.
Chifley, I think.
Oh, your Chifley book. And you've also written a book on Curtin.
Mm-hmm.
So what's next?
Well, now I'm working on a biography of Paul Keating, also of Bob Hawke, as two separate books. But, there'll be a couple of years down the track, I guess. And it will be as testing an experience, I think, as writing the biography of Antarctica.
There's a question here.
Is that an authorised biography?
Not at the moment.
Is either author, I mean, is Bob Hawke cooperating?
There is more cooperation from his tent. Yes.
Well, writing a book on Antarctica should qualify you to handle Paul Keating's evident coldness about people who write about him.
Yes. Well, I'm prepared for it. Anyway.
Well, no doubt. Have I missed anyone? Because we've gone about 25 minutes now, so I think we're right. Okay, well, that's fine, David. I'll just formally thank you. So as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of Antarctica, a biography, which I must say is a substantial body of work in here. I don't quite know how David does all this work, but he's hugely prolific, probably the most prolific Australian historian, I suspect.
This is 5 years' work.
5 years' work, but it combines with other stuff you've been doing as well. So, but it's a very impressive body of work, and I'm sure it will also go well in Europe and North America when it's launched. But it's great that it's come out in Australia first, and it's a very important topic in an area where not that much work has been done. So, as I said, Janet Grundy's got copies of it. David's always informative. He's always entertaining. And we've had another informative and entertaining address tonight. No doubt he'll be back again in the future, possibly on Paul Keating or Bob Hawke or both. But for now, well done, and bon voyage to the Antarctica.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.